Not only do we have this racist Keebler elf as our attorney general, but he's also potentially a Russian shill.
Hello, and welcome to Arbitration and Arbiter Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kramer. I'm joined this week by Editor-in-Chief Sophia Freuden and our frequent contributor, Kenzie Seifert. Y'all want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, this is Sophia. I was gone for 2 weeks, but now I'm back. I promise I didn't die.
Hi, I'm Kenzie. I was here last week, and I'm less sick.
That's good. Less sick and not dead. Two things I like to hear, I guess. Okay, so we are looking at two topics this week, both related to members of Donald Trump's cabinet. First off is Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his War on Drugs 2.0. And we're also going to be taking a look at the relatively or surprisingly or scarily free hand of the U.S. military under the leadership of Secretary of Defense Mad Dog Mattis. That might sound bad. I actually admire the man deeply. I might have a bit of a crush on him. Secretary Mattis, if you're listening, just give me a chance, please. Anyway, as I said, I have a bit of a crush on Mattis. He is a native son of the Pacific Northwest, which is always important to me. He's polished, thoughtful. He's widely revered in the U.S. military, has been referred to as one of the finest Marines in a generation. He's an intellectual. He has a personal library of over 6,000 books and carried a copy of Meditations by Marcus Aurelius on several of his deployments. In many ways, he is the ideal sort of person to be leading our military, especially when we have someone like Donald Trump in office. That being said, the shirking responsibility of our lovely abdicator-in-chief, Donald Trump, is concerning because of the longstanding principle dating back to the Truman era of civilian control over the military. As well, we have to take a look at Jeff Sessions' decisions, I guess you could say, about how we're going to be approaching criminal justice reform, or in his case, a retrograde view of how we should be handling criminal justice in general. First off, we have to go with Sessions. It is Arbitration's official editorial position that he is a racist Keebler elf on stilts who somehow escaped from the treehouse, and he must be forced back as soon as possible.
Birth name of Jelf Sessions, obviously.
Jelf?
Yeah. Birth name, obviously. Jeff Elf.
That just reminds Jelf. Me of MILF or DILF, and it's all upsetting. All of it is upsetting. Sophie, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I heard he makes fantastic cookies, so.
I mean, I heard he just hears things really, really well, just exceptionally. He tracks like a bloodhound. So that sense of smell is probably the cookie side of things coming in, I imagine. Sorry, go ahead.
Are we done just smearing Jeff Sessions through the mud?
Oh no, we're going to be doing that the entire time. We're never going to be done with that. Not until he's dead, but I think he's going to be long remembered as a terrible Keebler elf of an AG. Anyway, we should probably move on to something substantive and not just general shilling on Jeff Sessions. Anyway, his drug policies, as currently articulated, are dangerous and retrograde and reflect an old school drug warrior mindset that has been disproven by decades of failed policies and ineffectual drug enforcement, and the general understanding now that drug addiction is not a criminal issue, but a matter of, I don't know, a social issue, a medical issue, something to be dealt with through something other than prison sentences. He was actually considered so racist by 1980 standards that he couldn't get confirmed for a judgeship when he was nominated by Ronald Reagan. And now he's our AG. So, yeah, that's also bad. As well, he was the first senator to endorse Donald Trump when he was running for president, and then he was also appointed as AG, which kind of fits with the weird patrimonialism of Donald Trump that we've seen so far. He was deeply controversial when he was appointed and was confirmed on a narrow 52-47 party line vote. Most of the time in the news, what you've heard about him is his connections to Russia, possible connections to Russia, his meetings with Sergei Kislyak, things like that. But as far as I'm concerned, it's his drug policy that we have to be most concerned about because it's most impactful and it will mean suffering for literally millions of Americans if his desired return to mandatory minimums and such goes forward. So my question for you two to start the discussion. Do you believe that the interpretation of Jeff Sessions as an old school drug warrior, an ideologue, just someone who's so stuck in the 70s and 80s that he can't think of another way forward, another way of dealing with drugs. Do you think that's true? Or do you think that there's something else to the man? Is he just a brain dead, non-pragmatic ideologue or something else?
Oh, I think that he could think of another way forward and chooses not to move forward in that way. He just seems like a terrible person to me. And that's my official position on the matter. No, but in all seriousness, I think that what he's done not only doesn't make sense in terms of the way that the United States needs to deal with crime, but it's definitely, these are racist policies. And that's been shown time and time again in that Black and Hispanic people are incarcerated at a much higher rate and sentenced much more harshly than white offenders, especially for these small drug possession cases where the justice system wastes so much time and so many resources dedicating, you know, all of these efforts, these small time drug dealers or people who just are possessing small amounts of marijuana. I mean, what does that really matter when we have, you know, like the Brock Turner case where an actual rapist only gets 3 months in jail? Like, what kind of, it just makes me very angry.
So I'm going to say that I agree for the most part, but I worry that this discussion is going in too much of kind of an echo chamber or response bias direction. I think we need to take a look at the kind of era that he grew up in and specifically the culture that he grew up in. I do agree that his policies, specifically his recent memo that overrides the Obama era memo issued in 2013 by the Attorney General at the time, basically saying that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily pursue mandatory minimums at all times. So Jeff Sessions has basically said, you know, we're going to pursue these sentences to the highest possible level. And the way I see it is that it's a fact that not all criminal cases are the same. It's a fact that not all crimes are committed with the same intent. It's a fact that not all crimes are the same just across the board, right? So to say that across the board, we're going to pursue criminal charges to the highest extent kind of just flies in the face of reality. I'm a foreign policy nerd. I don't know too much about specifically criminal proceedings, criminal justice, et cetera. But just thinking about the basic logistics of how these things work, I don't think it's pragmatic to say that we're going to pursue a given, we're going to prescribe just this one size fits all policy to a whole cornucopia of crimes. As Kenzie has said, you know, there's a difference between a nonviolent crime involving, for example, a small amount of marijuana versus, I don't know, someone who is involved in a drug cartel and possesses illegal weapons and has potentially, you know, committed assault or murder. So those two things are very, very different in my mind. That being said, I think we also have to look at where he was raised. He was born in Alabama. He's a Southerner, you know, a native Southerner. As Alex has said, he was once derided as being too racist. And I think it's worth noting that he grew up during the segregation era in the South. And I think that has seriously impacted how he views crime, specifically drug-related crime. And as also has been mentioned in this podcast, this whole issue of drugs and the war on drugs, to me, when I hear these kinds of things, I think it's not just a war on drugs, it's a war against poor people. Specifically for Absolutely. Black Americans, poor Hispanic Americans. It's a war against sick people, people who are addicted to drugs. And it further worsens the situation where drug dealers have an economic incentive to push drugs into the American community, right? So it's just, all of this is so messed up. People often talk about the race aspect of what he's doing or the drug aspect of what he's doing. What, as Alex sort of briefly mentioned, is that this is much larger than that. This is an issue of international trade. This is a matter of public health. This is a matter of epidemiology, right? When you, for example, decriminalize drugs as Portugal has done, not only do your drug crimes obviously go away because you've decriminalized it, your overdose deaths go down as they have in Portugal, as does the transmission of HIV, hepatitis C, and a number of other diseases that can be transmitted by drugs, or rather needles. I just, the whole thing is so messed up.
Well, I think it's reflective of a mindset that isn't just that of Jeff Sessions. I think he is obviously the easiest person to point to because he is the AG. These are policies that he's crafted. But he crafted these policies. He put together the May 12th memo, which put forth the idea that mandatory minimums need to be pursued. He said specifically that it is a core principle of criminal justice that prosecutors should charge and pursue the most serious, readily provable offense. And one of the chief architects of that same memo, a man by the name of Stephen Cook, or Steve Cook, as I've often seen his name appear in articles, which is the third Steve in the Trump administration that just rubbed me the wrong way. Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon, now Mr. Steve Cook, wonderful Steves. Steve Cook said that, quote, when you put criminals in prison, crime goes down. And that's the sort of understanding and the sort of mindset which you can see in this policy. It's not that these people are sick people, as Sophia said. It's that these people are criminals. It's that anyone with any sort of contact with drugs must be a criminal. And that's the sort of bifurcated black and white worldview of an ideologue. And I personally do take the view that Jeff Sessions is an ideologue. He was born in 1946, for God's sake. I mean, he was brought up in the Deep South. He was brought up in an environment where the world was literally, in the case of the Deep South, black and white. And it's sort of a mentality that I think goes to the very core of him. He's an arch conservative. He's been around for a long time with these views. I think the most interesting thing is that he's linked up with someone, you know, he's a rock ripped conservative. And then he's linked up with someone like Donald Trump, who at one point advocated for a single payer healthcare system, who at another point argued that it was important for the country to take a step back from interventionism. Sessions, when he was in the Senate, was an infamous war hawk as well as an infamous debt hawk. So I think it's something that Eric Holder said in response to the May 12th memo really struck a chord with me. He said that this memo reflected a situation wherein voices who have not only been discredited, but until now have been relegated to the fringes of this debate, were now brought to the fore by this memo. And I think that's what we are seeing with Sessions and with Steve Cook and with Donald Trump himself and Steve Bannon and many others. We're seeing a fringe mentality and a rapidly dying mentality, or what was once a dying mentality, brought again to the fore. So yeah, it's a matter of non-pragmatic ideologues, in my opinion. Can we kind of generally agree on that moving forward?
Yes and no. Which is the answer to everything, really. yes and no. I, to an extent, can understand an explanation of, oh, he is a product of his time and where he, you know, grew up. Fine, but that's not an excuse. Like, it helps me to understand Jeff Sessions, but it doesn't help me to forgive the institution of these policies, if that makes sense. So that's where I stand on that. And as much as, you know, we can make the distinction that there is a difference between small time drug dealers who are commit nonviolent offenses and very violent drug traffickers, I don't necessarily trust the entire justice system to make that distinction. And that's where I find it, the entire policy, the most worrying.
Question for Kenzie. When you say the policy, which policy are you referring to specifically?
Oh, the policy of this new reversing Eric Holder's memo and pursuing mandatory minimums and the harshest possible charges, these sort of things, and the harshest sentencing. I don't think that's an answer to... That's an answer to a crime problem, but I really do think that this is more of a public health issue.
Yeah, that's very valid. And going off what Kenzie said, when I initially mentioned that, you know, Jeff Sessions was born in a region and born in an era that explains why he thinks the way he thinks, I don't think that that's an excuse for his behavior. We're all living in the 21st century. He served as a U.S. Senate. He has access to all sorts of information. He knows. I just think it's worth mentioning that I don't think it's just an ideological thing and something that, you know, a set of beliefs that he's chosen to adhere to. I also genuinely do think that it's, you know, just sort of how people in that time and that place were raised. Again, it doesn't excuse anything. It just points to the fact that it's not purely ideological. It's also, I would say, cultural, if you will.
And I'd say that's an important observation, because you would hope that any rational human being would be able to look at facts and change an opinion. I mean, it would be wonderful to believe that Jeff Sessions, after trying these policies for a few years, might realize, oh, well, that isn't working, or might be convinced, or might be possible to convince them, convince him at any point that these aren't the right approach. But as you said, Sophia, he grew up in an environment like that, and he's been this way for, I mean, literally decades. I mean, it's worth noting that he wasn't elected to the U.S. Congress until 1994. He went on to serve six terms, in the Senate. And the last time he was elected in 2014, he didn't even run opposed. So prior to that, though, he was working in criminal justice. He was working as an attorney general. He was elected after he was declined that, or after he was not confirmed for that judgeship in the 80s. He was elected the attorney general of Alabama, and he served in that position for 2 years. So it's easy to think about him as a politician first, but I mean, he went to law school and he worked as an attorney, as a U.S. attorney, and then later on as an AG of Alabama. So it's worth noting, because not only did he grow up in that environment, not only did he pick up those perspectives, but he embodied those perspectives for quite a long time. The racist remarks that that eventually sunk his appointment to the judgeship in 1981, they were things like, oh, I thought that the KKK were just fine until he found out that they smoked weed. And he also was on record, or it was alleged rather, not on record, but it was alleged that he viewed the ACLU and the NAACP as un-American. And I find it that even if he was joking, and that's what he claimed later, but jokes aside, that's, even if it was a joke, that's an incredibly messed up and insensitive thing to joke about. If he even has the connection in his mind of, well, this joke makes sense because of course weed is a bad thing, and of course that's on some different level than being a racist, I think it says something about how deeply he reviles drugs. And for that matter, I mean, Trump is in some ways in lockstep with him on these issues. He called and congratulated Filipino President Duterte, about his Duterte's operations against drugs back in April, claiming that he's doing a great job, an unbelievable job in dealing with drug crimes. And in that great job remark is killing drug offenders, people who possess drugs and people who sell drugs. So not only does Sessions have these perspectives, and they're unlikely to change, unamenable to change, but he's in an environment, he's surrounded by people who share these perspectives. The current acting director of the DEA, a guy named Chuck Rosenberg, insisted that marijuana is not medicine, despite, you know, years of research proving otherwise. So not only is he an ideologue, not only did he grow up in that environment, not only has he embodied these mentalities for decades as a member of the Senate and as an AG, AG of Alabama and as U.S. attorney, and now as U.S. AG, are people who seem to agree with him. So, yeah, the fact that he's an ideologue who's had these perspectives for so long is bad enough, but he's not likely to ever change. So we're stuck with these policies while Sessions and Trump are around. What are the likely impact of these policies going forward?
Well, I think it's, so the impact of specifically the drug policy will be such that we'll see, you know, if things revert to as bad as they used to be in terms of mandatory minimums and the number of people, you know, being incarcerated increasing, which the U.S. is, you know, has the highest incarcerated population in the world. We'll see if that gets worse than it would be had we continued with the Obama era policies. I think there's been perhaps somewhat of a fundamental shift in understanding or shift of sort of philosophy as to how these things get dealt with in the Justice Department, specifically the idea of restorative justice, meaning that, you know, the goal is to rehabilitate members into the community, not have multiple crimes, not have, oh geez, what's the word? Recidivism. There we go. To have as low recidivism as possible. We'll see what happens. My guess is things will get worse, but not as bad as they used to be. Again, in part because of a shift in general culture, not just, you know, outside of just sessions and even outside the federal system. We haven't really talked about the split between the federal and state systems, but that's also something that's really important because the federal system itself makes up only about, I want to say, less than 10% of all of these kinds of crimes, specifically drug-related crimes. The rest of them are, you know, prosecuted through state systems. So to say that Jeff Sessions will have a huge impact with his ideology is questionable.
I think that's fair enough. I agree with you on that, but I do still think that the effect that this will have, it will be tangible enough that it's problematic and I worry about it. I mean, one of the things that I worry about most is that Sessions has already directed the Justice Department to start using private prisons again to, quote, meet the future needs of the federal correctional system. And that concerns me because that's clearly placing a priority on criminalizing people and punishing them rather than encouraging lawful behavior to me. And I know that there is, like, the reason that we have prisons to begin with is it's a warning, and there are consequences when you commit crimes. And I understand that, but I still think that I think it places too high an accent on punishment, and there's not enough incentive to just be a lawful citizen. And I think that a big part of that also comes in with the, with AHCA, which cuts Medicaid and programs to help addicts overcome their addictions. So I think that those are factors that concern me.
I would agree with that. The idea of private prisons is so hair-raising. It gets talked about every now and again. We see it creeping up in headlines. But the fact that it's not more of a forefront issue is really concerning. And I think part of the reason why it's not a forefront issue is that this administration just as a whole has a manage of outdoing itself constantly in terms of scandals and such. But in previous episodes or in a previous episode, said that I was a capitalist. When it comes to the justice system, that is not a system that should be privatized at all. Jeff Sessions is an ideologue, but I think first and foremost, the most concerning thing about him is that he views the justice system as almost like a business, right? There's a quota to be filled. And that is disturbing. You know, we should be trying to prevent crimes. That's the first thing that the justice system should be doing is preventative measures, right? Not, again, as Kenzie said, this weird emphasis on punishment, simply because it produces the wrong kinds of incentives. It's not efficient. It's incredibly racist, incredibly classist, and hurtful to those with addiction and other medical problems that see them in these situations. The fact that private prisons are even legal, I think it flies in the face of human rights, personally. Like, that's just not acceptable.
Well, they've been illegal for the federal system. There was a legal decision back, I wish Jordan was with us right now, but there was a legal decision back in the Obama era that made it illegal for the feds to make use of private prisons. At the state level, they're still illegal, and the abuses that are, they're still legal at the state level, and the abuses that occur at the state level are heartbreaking is really the only word for it. One common phenomenon is that these private prisons have a clause in the contracts they have signed with the states, and this clause basically says that unless there is a minimum number of people contained in the prisons owned and operated by these private prisons, that the state has to pay a fine to the private to these private organizations that run these prisons, which obviously incentivizes people at the state level to ensure prosecutors at the state level to ensure that there are enough people in these prisons to avoid that fine, which for some states that are cash strapped, like, I mean, Oregon is a decent example, or even worse, a state like Illinois, which is in dire financial straits, an extra financial strain, like potentially hundreds of millions in fines from a private organization because you don't have enough people in a prison. Well, it's just easier to send people to prison at that point. So, I mean, and that's what's scary to me about him pushing for A, a return to mandatory minimums, and B, saying that we might need more private prisons. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, Sophia, with the idea of this almost being a supply and demand thing, like this being a constant sort of stream of criminals, and the idea that criminals are just a constant in society. It does de-emphasize crime prevention and crime and harm reduction in society. And I think it goes back to something I said earlier about the idea that criminals are not people who need help. They're not people who are impoverished. They're people who have done something wrong and must be punished for it. It's a dark perspective to have on human nature, and usually that's my job, but it's disturbing because it implies that these people think that there's no hope, and that there's no hope for many people, and that some people are always going to be criminals, and that you just have to put them away and put them, you know, neatly tuck them away out of sight. And especially when you connect that with the obvious issues we have in the United States with racialized crime and enforcement of crimes or enforcement of the law. I mean, back in the 90s, that the fact that you had two separate standards, and I think some of these laws are still in the books, but you had two separate standards, one for cocaine as a in powder form, and then a different standard for crack cocaine, the latter of which was cheaper and a more potent high and more addictive, and therefore was more common in poorer areas. Whereas, you know, someone like a current dear president back in the 80s probably did quite a lot of cocaine, I'm going to guess, especially being in New York at that time. It's part of a core issue in our society where double standards have become entrenched. And during the Eric Holder era under Obama, we made a concerted attempt as a country to reverse these things and try to make crime enforcement more equitable and actually make a move towards treating people as individuals instead of as criminals, as if that makes them a separate category of person. And now we're seeing the reversal of these ideas and the return to the notion that criminals are a separate category of person and that they'll always exist and that the only thing to do with them is to imprison them. And it takes rehabilitation right off the table, which flies in the face of human decency. I mean, it's been said often, and this is common knowledge, but just the sheer fact that there are more people imprisoned in the U.S. than any other country, even though we're the land of the free and the home of the brave, is sad. Not to accidentally quote our president.
It's very true. And I also do just want to quickly go back to it's almost shocking, this continuation of a concentrated effort to whittle away at Obama's legacy. I mean, Obama commuted the sentences of some 300 nonviolent drug offenders on his last full day in office. He made a very focused effort to move away from punishing those small-time offenders. And it's just sad to see a return to that when there are so many other things that we could be focusing on.
Well, it's not just pardoning, you know, small-time drug offenders. It's also Obama, the reason why the legal marijuana industry in the U.S. has grown so large, specifically it's now $6.7 billion in size, is that Obama largely ignored legal marijuana in states, right? In Oregon, Washington, California, I believe now, Massachusetts, Colorado, and a number of other places, including the District of Columbia. Marijuana possession is legal, and in most of those states regions I just listed, it's legal to sell as well. We'll see if what happens with, you know, the discussion that the Justice Department might now be pursuing vendors or people who are possessing marijuana in these states. That would put a serious damper on the industry there, not only harming the economy, but also it's just like a wasteful use of government dollars. You know, people on the right always talk about wasteful government spending. And I can't think of a more silly use of government money, aside from, of course, sending Trump to Mar-a-Lago every weekend.
Makes me so unhappy. Sorry to interrupt. That was an unconscious response.
Oh, no, it's fine. Actually, podcast host, can we talk about Sessions' ties to Russia? I just read a headline that Russia is calling Sergei Kislyak back to Russia, which is like a huge diplomatic signal, and I think an important thing to discuss in the
whole. No, please have at it.
Well, so you briefly mentioned that at the beginning of the podcast that Sessions had come under fire because he had undisclosed contact with that ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, and now Kislyak is being recalled. This has not been confirmed by any Russian news sources, but BuzzFeed apparently has three different news sources stating that Kislyak is being recalled. It's not clear as to why. In the cryptic language, that is diplo-speak. This could mean all sorts of things. You know, countries can recall ambassadors because the ambassadors were, behaving badly, which happens more often than you'd think. Diplomatic immunity does weird things to people. Or states can recall diplomats or ambassadors in a show of dissatisfaction with the hosting country's behavior or policy in some way. Kislyak has not only been involved with Sessions in terms of scrutiny over ties between Russia and the U.S. elections, but also with Flynn, the disgraced national security advisor who was fired a month into the Trump administration's tenure because he lied to Mike Pence about the nature of his communication with the Russians. So this whole thing is really interesting. Not only do we have this racist Keebler elf as our attorney general, but he's also potentially a Russian shill. Tom Clancy, we thank you for this novel twist. It's most interesting.
Yeah, Tom Clancy would also be a nice novel twist if this was all a dream. Just the whole, since November, like if we could all wake up and realize. Huh? What'd you say?
I said that's just bad writing, and it was all a dream.
It would be bad writing, but like, would you complain at this point?
I mean, it depends on what I'd be waking up to.
I mean,
it was all a simulation.
I mean, this is a simulation.
This is a simulation. It's a simulation run by Tom Clancy. Kenzie, where have you been? Get on the boat.
Yeah, this is
the red pill. I've been under a rock.
And I have been busily crafting a whole new cosmology for us based on Tom Clancy as, God, more or less.
Don't tell my grandma. Don't forget the status of excessive sunscreen. She's my personal favorite.
That's true. Oh, yeah. Just everyone don't tell my grandma. Like, I'm pretty sure she would be. I feel like I say that fairly often. Just a general, no one tell my grandma that this podcast exists mostly. I feel like she'd be really bothered by a lot of things that I say. Worshipping Tom Clancy is potentially the tip of the iceberg, to be honest.
Well, and now you have a public crush on Mattis. I don't know how she'd feel about that either.
I'm not going to apologize for that. I'm just not. Though, better idea, Mattis marries my grandma. Can you imagine Mad Dog Mattis as your grandpa? That would be amazing.
Just, terrifying.
Christmas, I mean, I could borrow books from his library, though.
All right, we were getting so off topic.
Yeah, we really are. Every single data point that I've ever looked at on this topic just screams, yo, treating drugs as a criminal offense is wrongheaded. Not only because it destroys people's lives for no particular purpose half of the time, but also simply because it's not sensible to treat addiction as if it's a crime. It makes no sense.
To treat drug use as if it's morally deplorable.
That's the thing. That's exactly
the
thing.
So it's morally bad to kill someone, right? I feel like that's a universal truth. But to use drugs, right? On the issue of is drug use moral, you can throw arguments at it like, oh, well, what if you're a mother responsible for children and you're, doped out of your mind or something? To which my response is, why would a mother who has children or a child knowingly use drugs and not care? Chances are she's in a situation caused by poverty or something else, medical addiction, what have you, that prevents her from making what is the responsible decision in that situation. So I view drug use, even though it can be problematic, it isn't always problematic, such as in the case of marijuana. It's not something to be treated as a plague in our society or as a morally bankrupt activity. It is not murder. It is not assault. It is not rape. It is not theft,
I think the conservative argument would be that drugs themselves aren't, and this is actually something that that Sessions said at one point, and when I was going through the information we have for this episode, Sessions argues that drugs and crime are just intrinsically linked, that all the things you listed as being more severe from a moral perspective go hand in hand with drugs. And I find that to be, that's literally only because, drugs are criminalized. Like you said, when you have a debt to when you're a drug dealer and someone owes you money, you don't go to court to collect that money. You collect it via the barrel of a gun, which is true and accurate, but that's missing a point of like, well, possibly some of those drugs shouldn't be criminal. There's only violence when people can't, like, drugs are only sources of violence in a society when they are part of the black market, when they are underground, when they have to necessarily be underground. When you have someone who buys something illicitly and they're at the mercy of someone who is selling that thing illicitly, then it only makes sense that there's going to be situations where that leads to violence. But if that was all out in the open, a person who owed a drug dealer money, but that drug dealer was selling that stuff legally, in that situation, that person could seek other means to achieve redress other than violence. So I think it's this idea of it being a moral plague. And as I said earlier, the idea of criminals being a different class of person.
I apologize. I'm going to point back to the case of Portugal. I love case studies, and I love this case study in particular. Portugal decriminalized. It didn't legalize. It decriminalized all drugs across the board in 2001. And what that means is that it's not legal to buy them or possess them or sell them. But if you get caught, instead of getting thrown in prison, you not only will you not get thrown in prison, you won't even get a criminal record. Instead, you get a false small fine. And often you just get referred to like a hospital to seek medical treatment mm-hmm. for your drug usage, which is a little tricky with non-addictive or typically non-addictive drugs, such as marijuana. Again, can be addictive, not always. Or, you know, cocaine or heroin, which is highly addictive. So it's a little iffy there. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, treating all crimes the same is not okay because they're different. All drugs the same is not okay because not all drugs are as dangerous as each other or are dangerous just in general.
And here's where we mention alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah, well, tobacco kills people, well, as does alcohol. Tobacco causes cancer, and alcohol is far more destructive than marijuana is in terms of deaths caused by motor accidents, for example.
22,000 a year.
Yeah, or drinking until you die, alcohol poisoning. So very real concerns. But you don't hear conservatives asking for another prohibition. We tried it. It didn't work. I think it's time to consider the same kind of policies for the 21st century. We've been doing this war on drugs, quote unquote, since the Nixon administration, and it's failing. It's failing American families. It's failing American society. Drug cartels are as strong as ever. And no attorney general that I know of that genuinely cares about the people who live in his country would advocate for these policies knowing these facts.
Well, yeah, and I think his counter response, because I guess the only person in this conversation who was ever at any point a conservative, I kind of have to try to put that hat on for a second. I think his reply would be, well, if people know the penalties and they make a decision to use those drugs anyway, then they deserve the punishment, and that it's not his fault necessarily that they're doing that, and he's just enforcing the law, which is you can kind of see that. Sorry.
Has he ever lived in poverty?
I'm having a bit of a weird time here because I'm thinking in these two different sort of mindsets. Because as I was saying that, my next thought was, well, people who use drugs criminally aren't necessarily using drugs criminally just flippantly. The example of the pregnant mother or the mother caring for kids who's using drugs is, I think, an ideal one. Because how many people do you know who are having a great life? Everything is going perfectly. How many people do you know in that situation decide to find heroin? You know, like I mean, Cambridge is actually in many ways a great example. Drugs are rife here. There are many instances. There's actually a story a while back in one of the national papers here in the UK about the amount of drugs used by Cambridge students. About it is you know that these things are happening, but everyone's still, I mean, the number of times that students have left because of that, statistically speaking, it's very low. It's because these drugs are used recreationally, and people don't choose to allow it to take over their life because they have other things to do and other opportunities that might be threatened by excessive use of drugs. But if you're stuck in a cycle of poverty, drug usage seems, I mean, I can only imagine how many times people have decided to try a drug after saying something along the lines of, oh, well, screw it. You know, what other, if you have very little to lose, then that's going to impact your behavior. So the interlinkage between drug use and poverty is something that's often ignored when people think about drug use and criminals as just all bound up together as morally nefarious individuals.
Well, and then I would also like to bring it back to a bigger picture. I do want to bring up self-medication. Many of these people in poverty can't afford to go see a doctor for anxiety or depression or things like that. Even outside of how stigmatized that is in especially small town communities. And so a lot of the times that can turn into self-medication using drugs, whether that's prescription or whether that's, you know, heroin or anything else.
Yeah, I mean, and that's also how it goes with the opioid crisis. I mean, people start on opioids and then they get increasingly expensive as their tolerance builds up. They need more and more in order to keep up with the high that they got. And then eventually they turn to heroin because it's cheaper, more plentiful, and oftentimes much more potent. And yeah, it's a confounding process. It's a confounding thing to watch from the outside, especially considering that many of the areas that Trump was advocating to directly in the election and the sort of place that rural areas in the South, the sort of place that Jeff Sessions himself came from, those are the places that are being negatively impacted by the opioid crisis. But they're not necessarily thinking in terms of, well, these people are, you know, are people I know. They're thinking about them as a separate category of person again. And it's just, it's frustrating and it makes me quite sad.
2017 in a nutshell.
Frustrating and sad. Woo! All right. Well, thank you folks for listening to episode 12 of Arbitration. I would like to thank our podcast editor, Steph Reeves, our creative designer, Drake McFarlane, our editor-in-chief, Sophia Freuden, who is currently on the podcast with us. You can find our host website, Arbiter, at arbiter.org. And you can also find us on Twitter at arbiter.org, as well as on Facebook. And if you have any questions or suggestions for episodes, you should tweet at us on Twitter. Thank you and have a nice week.